Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup, where we sample what's currently going on in Creative Cambridge, preview new shows and talk to the people who make it all happen. This edition focuses in and around buildings, using interior spaces differently or indeed putting buildings up with a bit of flair and architectural imagination. In this edition, Italian kinetic artist Floridia Ferrara talks about her new exhibition just opened at the Cambridge Arts Salon in Cromwell Road, using sophisticated mobiles to turn interior spaces into something quite extraordinary. Photographer Helena Anderson presents a talk on finding, drawing and photographing interesting objects at Williams Art, and then takes us to see the Family Adams Project in Littleport, where the artefacts come from, an antiquated shop now turned over to an arts team, but which is badly in need of funding. We hear the story of an exceptional Cambridge City architect with artist and historian John Harris, and discover the man behind the look of much of the city's commercial centre and its most popular alehouses. And Wisding Arts Centre in Bourne welcomes four new resident artists after 617 applications are put in. But first, let's take a look at a selection of what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. The Arts Theatre presents Anne Boleyn by Howard Brenton, a play that lets Boleyn's ghost do her some retrospective justice in a new look at the vicious world of Henry VIII's Tudor court and her role as a pawn in the political game that opens on March the 15th. Also at Cambridge Arts Theatre, rock and roll musical Save the Last Dance for Me opens on March the 19th, a dirty dancing teenage bonanza directed by Bill Kenwright and Keith Strachan. Cambridge University's Wind Orchestra is giving a schools concert for children at West Road Concert Hall on March the 12th. And the London Classic Theatre presents shocking psychodrama Equus by Peter Schaeffer at the Mumford Theatre on March the 13th to 15th. How often do you find yourself sitting in a room or an office, staring at an empty and boring space that doesn't exactly trigger new and interesting thoughts? Well, if you want to do something a bit different with the space, you might think about filling it with some kinetic art to inspire you and get those brainwaves going. A new exhibition that explores balanced and moving art has just opened at Cambridge Art Salon in Cromwell Road. From Motion to E-Motion is an exhibition of kinetic art and installations by Floridia Ferrara, which runs until March the 13th. Floridia is originally from Palermo in Italy and is currently learning Tai Chi and teaching tango dance lessons. Both activities inspire her work because they combine both balance and movement. She introduces the show, which is handmade using a range of materials and has connotations of the universe and solar system.
Balance and movement are very important for you because you're an artist who deals in kinetic art, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
What is kinetic art for the uninitiated?
Okay. Kinetic art is an art which contains moving parts, and it started in the beginning of the 1900s in the US. The father of all mobiles is considered to be Alexander Calder, and he was actually inspired by Marcel Duchamp, and who in reality created the first kinetic artwork, but it wasn't a mobile.
You are about to launch an exciting new exhibition at Cambridge Art Salon,
yes,
which is going to detail some mobiles. Can you tell me a little bit about those?
Yes, these structures generally hang from the ceiling, at least the one I create, and they have different patterns in movement. I use different materials to build them, so I explore wood, copper, resins, and recycled objects. I everything that actually catches my attention is...
I saw on your website, I've been looking at some photographs, obviously you've got some amazing things that look like wooden balls with things growing out of them.
Yes.
That those move around with sort of a very interesting way, that the things that come out of them are not straight, they're kind of crooked. And and those is there a connection with the sort of planetary system or the universe for those?
Actually, this is something very interesting you are saying, because Jean-Paul Sartre actually defined kinetic art, and specifically the ones of Calder, to be an expression of the universe and the balance of planets and that are around us.
I mean, I see that those balls are—they look like spheres, okay?
Yeah,
and then they have things coming out of them. So, is that sort of regenerative thing that there's life coming out of them?
Yes. The mobile you are referring to, it is called the Natural Multiple Equilibrium. And this is the biggest artwork I've done, and it's 3.20 meters in diameter, and it's huge. It's for a big hall. It is actually I draw inspiration reflection from nature in that case. And it took quite a long time to build it, nearly a year.
Can you tell me about the new work that's going to be in this exhibition, which is just...
I'm going to exhibit 6 or 7 mobiles. Some of them are going also to change your perception with light, because some of them are glowing in the dark. So I will use specific lights to also enhance this feature they have.
With mobiles, it's very much about filling empty spaces, isn't
yes.
it? Yes. There's a space that's not doing anything, there's nothing to stimulate you in it, but if you fill it with mobiles, something completely extraordinary happens,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. People love to lay down, actually, and observe them from the bottom. And this is one of it's the moment where you can actually see how they change and how this actually is going to affect you. I think that just the observer needs to take some time to really enjoy them.
Is it important for them to be a little bit perplexing, or what do you think?
People are quite caught by them because they, first of all, I think they get a sense of relaxation. And also, I think the balance of them and the slow movement actually inspire many people, and they enter into a different state of consciousness. So that's my target as well.
Obviously, there's lots of types of mobiles that you've done. You've done ones which center on a theme of frogs,
yes,
on flowers, on stairs, exotic themes, and so on. What are your influences, and why do you draw upon them?
Well, my influences, actually, when I started, many years ago, more than 10 years ago, I didn't even know about the fathers of all mobiles, Calder. So everything actually started in a very simple way. I saw some stickers in a shop, and there were moons, and I was so... I did like them a lot. Yeah. So one day I thought, what can I do with that? Yeah. And then I decided to hang them, since they were glowing in the dark. I decided to have, you know, to build a small structure so this could actually be in my ceiling and I could lay down and relax watching them also during the night. So everything started in a simple way. Then I find out that actually it's an art and it's a part of the sculpture.
Now, the title of your exhibition is From Motion to Emotion.
Yes.
What does that mean exactly?
The title of my exhibition actually can be read in two different ways. From motion to emotion, and also from motion to motion. That's why the E is in a different color.
Ah, right, okay.
So you can go from one kind of motion of one mobile to the other. Or you can, I think that from the motion of these mobiles, many people actually get many different state of consciousness, and some of them get really, you know.
Is it important to have music while you're watching them?
For some of them, it could be, it actually helps.
Yeah.
I did the artwork you were talking before, actually has a soundtrack. And it's not necessary, but it can be, if you want to play some music while watching them, it's fine, because also the music interacts with our brain as the movement does. So it's a good experience.
A new sound for a new generation. This is Cambridge 105.
It's no secret that we're all photographers now in the event of mobile phones. And lots of people have been taking the opportunity to push their visual talents in catching the unusual images thrown up by the blanket of snow recently. But if you want to take the science a little further without it costing you a fortune, you might try dropping into a lunchtime talk at William's Art in Gwydir Street. I attended one given by professional photographer Helena Anderson, who was teaching a group about perspectives and appreciating interesting objects to understand how to get the best out of them for either drawing or taking pictures. The rusty artefact she presented came from a forge in old ironmongery in Littleport, where she's photographically documenting a project which has attracted £49,000 in heritage lottery funding. It's a perfectly preserved, antiquated shop and contents, which was run by the Adams family, which has now sparked huge local interest and was once the town's hub and centre for fen skating and commerce. The Family Adams project seeks to preserve and re-establish the antiquated shop, turning it over to a cultural centre, and could create an important new arts hub in the Fens if it can get adequate funding. Helena Anderson talks about the inspiration that's sucking people in to do creative things.
My little talk is about a project that I'm working on in Littleport as a preservation project. We're looking after an old building, an old ironmongery shop, and I've been privileged to being given the task to photograph all the objects we're finding in the interior of the shop. And I'm also a member of the Cambridge Arts Movement, and some of the artists here have organised art classes on a Sunday afternoon, and I've come in with some of the finds to talk about the project and about the visual beauty of everything that we found. The shop also had a forge. They used to make things, and they're just beautiful shaped objects and maybe of interest for the students to draw. The exercise is to look at the object or part of an object, a three-dimensional object, or make it sort of flat so that they just see colour, and to then let their imagination inspire them and do something beautiful with or record it. I think what I like to do and what I'm trying to do is probably try and make the ordinary look extraordinary.
Yeah.
So speaking out the detail. And I'm used to looking. I've been an interior designer for about 30 years, so my eyes never rest. I look at things, and I think I can see. So you can look, but you don't necessarily see. And I think what I'd like to do with my photography is make people see if they see my photographs. It's always very spontaneous seeing what I do. You know, I do sometimes premeditate. You know, when I do my scene setting, it is creating something and then photographing. But I often also, you know, as most photographers, you know, you walk around and you have a camera and you have to capture something because it's exciting or beautiful.
Helena, we've been looking at one of your classes, looking at some wonderful objects at Williams Art. We've now moved to the Family Adams project in Littleport in Ely, where some of those objects came from. Can you tell me a little bit about the range of things that you found here that have that kind of aesthetic significance, worth photographing, worth looking at, that people are looking at here?
Yes. I mean, most of the things that we found come from the little barn outside. Many of them would have been made in a forge. So it's all, you know, metal and steel. We found mostly probably little jugs, very old and very, very rusty, very crumbly. Under normal circumstances, I guess somebody would say, God, what a dirty old thing, and would sling it. But if you take the thing out in isolation and you look at it from a very different point of view, i.e. something of beauty, and then photograph it out of context, then it just becomes a beautiful visual thing to look at. It takes my fancy.
Now, this story has been brought to life wonderfully with all the documents and obviously the photographs. Can you tell me about some of the photographs in your photographic display here? Because you have a series of images of documents and things. I know that some of them came from the Cambridgeshire collection, didn't they?
Yes, we have primarily old photographs from the archive library, some catalogues, pictures from catalogues that relate to this particular period, which is the early 20th century. We haven't really sourced outside of, you know, the confines of the Adams sort of shop to find objects. Although we may, because one of the curators at Denny Abbey came here today, and he's got some stuff that might interest us. So Nicola and I are going to visit and do some more photographing. But no, all the things that I photographed, all the things come from this particular shop.
It's great to have like a collaboration of so many different people focusing on one really intriguing place with so much history attached to it. It enables people to, not only the community obviously are enjoying it very much, bringing in their memories and things that they know about the shop, but it's also having that the chemistry of a group of people who all have those skills to bring things to life and make them interesting for people to work together and to do that for the community here.
It's many of us work in isolation normally, but it's really been amazing how we've come together with our individual skills and how we have enjoyed working together and how we learn from each other.
Archivist and project curator Nicola Powers has the job of assembling the archive for the project. She says it's fascinating for the whole community.
Okay, Nicola, here we are in this marvellously atmospheric, a beautifully preserved old building, which seems to have basically stopped in time about 100 years ago without being wrecked or ruined, and it's a treasure trove of interesting things. How did you come to find out about it?
The project really started with one person, Jean Rees-Lyons, who's the local playwright. And she was visiting the shop, she lives in Littleport, and she was mesmerised by what was still here. And her relationship with Susan and David Porter, she got to know the shop, the history behind it, the fact that it's been in three generations of the same family, and the beautiful panelling and the shelving and all of the drawers, the 171 drawers that are here, and all of the original fittings, she was just mesmerised by. She found out a little bit more that was kept in the shop, and has learnt about Doris Adams, who was the last person of the Adams family who managed the shop, and got intrigued by her character and learning a lot about her personal life. And from that, she was very much driven to trying to preserve and record all of this before it was sold, and applied to Heritage Lottery Fund for a community grant, and that was given. And she brought together a mixture of people, range of artists who are phenomenally talented, to record everything, every part of the building and every part of the archive, and also myself to have some interest in the heritage part of it as well.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the things that are contained here? Because you not only have beautiful old books, you have original manuscripts, you've got all the original, it's like stepping back in time 100 years, and you have records, you have incredible objects. I mean, there's everything from bedpans to old books to rusty materials, and these are all being preserved, they're being photographed, and they're being catalogued.
Yes, they've been found. Everything, it's very, very unusual to find a shop that has all of its original fittings for so that's 100 years old, and to find objects on site that were sold here or were going to be sold, and to have a full business archive from about 1910 right up until the sort of early 80s that details everything that was sold here. There are trade catalogues that have beautiful pictures of some of the household items, some of the agricultural items that were sold here. At one point, you're looking through some of these copperplate written ledgers, and people are buying oil, screws, tiny bolts. Other people are bringing their kettles to be repaired here. Some people are buying brass beds from here. It was absolutely everything that related to community life in Littleport and around.
How important is it, do you think, for a place like Littleport to have not only a sort of historical perspective, but actually to have a hub for the community for both arts and history, and anyone who's interested in preserving the culture of a place like this?
I think it's so important. It's absolutely crucial, because Littleport has such a fascinating history anyway. It's a lot of it that people maybe underestimate, the history that it relates to this town, how important it was within the north of Cambridgeshire and into the Wash. It's so, so important. There's a wealth of talent here, and this to have in the centre of a town such a fantastic, unique building, it would be a shame not to be able to do something and transform it so that generations to come would enjoy learning about the history and also experiencing some kind of art activity or learning through arts through that. Looking at some of the items that have been found, they have been very useful, but they've a historical value, but they're absolutely beautiful. We've got a Helena Anderson photographing material that's actually turning them into works of art. We have people who somebody doing a model of the outbuildings and the shop, and absolutely beautiful experience, all of that talent that could be used within an arts hub within Littleport as well. It's just wonderful today. The main thing from this open day, we're just getting such a feeling from people that they want this to stay and that they want this to be useful and to be relevant for people in Littleport now.
All of this was preserved quite miraculously, wasn't it, by a gentleman's agreement. How did that happen?
Well, the people who own the shop at the moment still, Mr. and Mrs. Porter, David and Susan, they had close connections with the family and the shop before they bought it. And the shop has been through three generations: John Henry Adams, Joseph Henry Adams, and Doris Adams. And when she died in the early 80s, it went to her nephew. And between the nephew and David Porter, they had a gentleman's handshake,
to say that you can buy the building, but you must not change any part of that building. And if it wasn't for David Porter and Susan providing this legacy, we wouldn't be here today looking at it and being able to talk about developing something special for Littleport.
Now, we're upstairs in the building, and this used to be an area which was used as a repository for ice skates, where in the winter during the snowy season, people could come in and try their hire and try on ice skates and set off. So it was actually, it had lots of different functions, didn't it?
Yeah, but the more that we find from looking at some of the historical material, realise how important this shop was to not just Littleport, but the wider area. Fence skating, as you may know, is just absolutely phenomenal in this area. And the shop here sold fence skates to world championship skaters from Littleport, to other ironmongers to around the area, and even to the National Skating Association. They had imported skates from Norway, from Hagen Skates in Oslo, and they did that over quite a number of years. The height of that period was probably around about the 1920s. And it was vitally important.
You've only actually got funding at the moment to last for about 6 months.
Well, it's only going to last until the end of May.
End of May. And if this project can attract some new funding, it can actually take off properly here, can't it?
It really could. If there's the original purpose of the project was to record what was here before it would go.
Yeah.
It's so clear that this building has such a passionate following that it would be a shame not to get any more funding to do something with it. We are very, very keen to seek funding to develop in any kind of arts and heritage function for the building.
The project not only involves local museums, schools, photographers and artists, but it also draws on the personal memories of the shop from local people who are coming in to write them down and contribute to the shop's living history. A story of the Adams family is now emerging, and local writer and playwright Jean Rhys-Lyons, who initiated the whole project, has focused on the life of Doris Adams, whose life story has been researched and written up as a play called The Gypsy Play, and will be performed by local children.
Can we talk a little bit first about Doris Adams, because her history was discovered in an extraordinary way here, wasn't it, in the outhouses?
Yes, it was.
Can you tell me what happened?
Well, there's one photograph, the one known photograph that we have of Doris. It's taken in 1920 of her when she was 17 with her uncle in a rickshaw. From looking at that, all kinds of things have happened. Doris was born in 1903, a very intelligent girl and young woman, and went away to Leeds University to read botany.
Yeah.
And of course they did botany at the time because they were not supposed to do anything that was at all to do with sex and gender and all those things that really could be important. So she went to university. She came back from university in 1926 with a glowing testimonial from her professor, Priestley, suggesting that she should go into teaching, that she was a clear-minded, wonderful woman. And then we also found, which is very interesting, another reference from a professor, written again in 1926, saying that Doris Elizabeth had taken a very active part in a hostel and the activities that were going on there, and that indeed she would make a wonderful science teacher. However, that particular letter was found in a pristine condition at the back of a very old, miserable, dirty forge drawer. So this letter has not been seen for 80 years or more. However, the question is, who folded it up? Why was it hidden in an outbuilding when Doris had come back from university ready to start a career in teaching, when actually she ended her life as a reclusive figure next door to the shop?
Now, there was a trunk found in one of those outhouses as well, wasn't there? What was in that?
That was full of her old exercise books. She was very, very particular. We have her original Cambridge exams. Sometimes, to get through to university, she took up to 5 exams a day. And, of course, she did chemistry and botany, chemistry, sciences, Shakespeare. And she was dedicated to church. To her life here and to doing good. However, she also had a very interesting hidden social life. The play itself is an amalgam of research, memory, intuition, real things and unreal things. There are characters who are still alive today, we have interviewed. People who have come into this open day today, standing in front of the counter that Doris Elizabeth stood in front of, saying, I used to go to Sunday school and Doris took me upstairs. We had Bible class and then we went into her garden to have cakes and tea. And that sort of thing is happening. The children are learning to respect the history, their own history. And in doing that, they're actually recreating a history, which will be recreated in this piece of work.
The play is called The Gypsy Play, isn't it? Yeah. When will it be performed?
It's going to be performed on Saturday evening, the 28th of April, and Sunday matinee, the 29th.
And that will be here at the shop?
No, it's going to be at the Village Hall.
Village Hall.
At the Village Hall.
You found us.
This is Cambridge 105. If you think you know your Cambridge pretty well as a local, you're probably not aware that you also probably know one of its principal but lesser known architects firsthand, since you're bound to be personally familiar with at least one of his many works. I'll give you a clue. He designed the renovations of Cambridge's Corn Exchange, not just recently but back in 1875, but I'm sure that probably doesn't ring much of a bell either, and that's why his story really has to be told. He's now certainly long dead, but he's also the man responsible for large swathes of the city's commercial architecture, for churches, schools, shop fronts and residential buildings which we all now routinely enjoy. And most importantly for most townsfolk, he built dozens of the city's very best alehouses. If you're perhaps standing at the Market Passage at the B Bar this evening for a drink, or next door in Bar Tabouche, or the Red Cow Pub, or maybe the Mitre in Bridge Street, why not stop for a second and think a little bit about the building, both inside and out? On close inspection, you'll be intrigued at architect Richard Reynolds Rowe's creations and all the features he designed. Richard Reynolds Rowe's career has been closely documented by local artist, historian and calligrapher John Harris as a man who had an astonishing career shaping Cambridge's streets, and it's all the kind of stuff that you can enjoy yourself while idly waiting for a bus or downing a pint outside. We took a walking tour of the city centre to look at some of the achievements of Rowe, whose prestigious appointments as town planner and architect included being surveyor of the Isle of Ely under Sir George Gilbert Scott on engineering aspects of the rebuild of Ely Cathedral. I joined John Harris at the Corn Exchange to hear about how Rowe transformed that building after winning a commission in 1868 in a competition with six other architects.
Most corn exchanges built around this time would cling on to at least vestiges of classical architecture. If you think of the one in Sudbury, which is now the public library, or the great big one from roughly the same time as here in the Tuesday Marketplace in King's Lynn, that has vast stone columns on the outside. And there were probably lots of people in the university who would be saying, why couldn't he have made it Gothic? Because there was, that fight was still on. He did it this way. And Pevsner, when he came along in the 1950s, said that this was a completely outlandish building. He made it belong to a kind of German way of building, round arch style, Rundbogenstil. And indeed, every arch that you see here is a geometrical, you know, is a segment of a circle. It's either a semicircle or a long arc of a circle, like those great double arches at, you know, sort of double our height.
It's marvellously robust, isn't it? I mean, it's like some of the old railway buildings that were built during that era. It's terribly solid and very purpose-built as well, isn't it?
Yes, and it does it both inside and outside. And most people wouldn't get into those railway buildings, but they would see them from outside, or engineering works. And this one continues that architecture with terrific force and, I would say, dignity inside as well.
And he did select his materials very carefully. These are clay bricks, aren't they, that came originally from Ely, and he brought the iron from Belgium. He was not a man who would quibble about the materials that he used. He knew what he wanted to do, and he set about doing it, however difficult it was.
Oh, he knew his bricks, Simon. Yeah. He absolutely, you know, he was a master of brick detailing, and I think that he could probably by hand have done anything that you see here, though I've got no proof of that at all. But I have a theory that he taught the brickies of Cambridge what could be done.
Do you know anything about his character generally? I mean, as a man, what was he like?
There's something in the fact that he didn't go for big jobs. I think he was probably reluctantly persuaded to put in for a job like this. And he wasn't the characteristic Victorian architect who had to be in every competition or had to do the big town church. He didn't do those things. He didn't mess with colleges. And he did churches as they were needed, and they were done in stripy brick like this, St. Philip's, or that remarkable one, St. Matthew's.
Yeah.
He always had something to give to a building, so that the railings around Great St. Mary's were done by him. And there's a building that doesn't have any author, but I think it's got to be him, that I love because of the beauty of its detail. It's entirely clad in little field pebbles, and it's the church, or rather mortuary chapel, of All Souls Churchyard, now used by Eric Marland as his letter cutting studio. But if you want to go up and see an extraordinary ensemble of beautiful, almost French, delicate little building, delicate robust, with a little lead spire in a veritable arboretum of Victorian trees, and of course the graves of some of the great college masters and people like Wittgenstein, which you're free to go to, and you can knock on the chapel door as well and see what's happening in there. I think this shows what a graceful and modest man he could be.
Okay, now obviously he had an effect on not just on the Corn Exchange. Obviously it's a principal building that everybody knows very well, but there are many other places in Cambridge where his hand can be seen. We'll go and have a look at those now.
That would be fun, especially on a day like this.
Okay, we're in the Market Square now, John. What's the next thing?
Yes, we're looking across the market from outside Gap, and we're looking at the east end of Great St. Mary's. Now, he very possibly looked after the fabric of Great St. Mary's, but he didn't mess it about at all. Rowe contributed the railings, which are robust and have some beautiful finials to them, which we'll probably notice in a moment. But the building I would love to call your attention to is something that's come out of the doldrums in the last couple of years, and it's the hotel building on the corner with that very seaside turret of a kind that you might find in Eastbourne or Rill or somewhere like that, and big double dormers. It is now the King's Market Hostel. It looks almost as it did when built. You can see how fine it is in terms of its texture and built mass. And we're going to walk along the side of it, and I'm going to show you a little building which I think has to be by Rowe, and it brings somebody else into the story, somebody who almost certainly contributed those paintings of corn sheaves to the Corn Exchange, and that's Fred Leach, who ought to be famous in this place. He was the great craftsman supplying colleges and private people and shop owners with woodwork, painted surfaces, stencil designs, stained glass, and many other things. They're still there, and whenever Morris and his friends came up to do college jobs, as they did for Jesus and Queen's and Peterhouse, etc., they used 37 City Road, those lovely wooden sheds, as their base, and really they ought to be scheduled monuments. As a man with a real engineering understanding, he could be called in as a reliable man to prop your house up while you had a new shop front put underneath, whether you were using iron or timber to do the business. And yet, having done this entirely modern thing, he clothes it as a Jacobean building. You can see the columns at the end to the right of the shop front. He uses leaded glass throughout, especially over the little fan light over the front door, which has bottle glass in it, bobbly stuff. But I think it's this this lovely, perky ensemble that he creates, fearlessly standing next to one of his own buildings there, and he covers it, if you look closely, with little tantalizing designs on the flat, and then these sticky out bits and rosettes and so on. And even the bracket to the sign has a real character of its own. It's full of twiddliness. Look at those knobbly twigs coming out of the top. And that will remind you of what he loved to do in silhouette on the top of the Red Cow pub, you know, the dragony bits there. But I think that he did a whole lot for the commercial look of Cambridge and keeping that fine in the 19th century.
It seems the secret to finding and appreciating Rowe is always to look up and learn to spot his particular style in decorations, and it quickly becomes a hobby to fill an unforgiving minute. The first thing to spot are turrets and elaborate multicoloured brickwork. There's also moulded brackets from the gas lamp era which Rowe put in, elaborate chimneys and big upper floor windows of the Georgian 12-pane variety which Rowe preferred.
Okay, we're now in Market Passage.
Yes, we've come through a little patch of darkness off Market Street opposite Trinity Church, and there's nothing to see for a moment until suddenly we look up at the sky and the buildings that go up on either side of us. The stripy and speckly one on the left, which is full of Rowe's characteristic details, and I think, you know, people who look at that will know that they've seen a house with windows like that. But it does have the most glorious details to the shop front, not easily seen because Karen Millen goes in for black and has painted everything black, including much of what would normally be window space, and most shops would need more glass than we see at the moment. But it's the pillared brackets at each side, and then on the right hand side, the block that used to be part of the Eden Lily Empire, and that retains to a large extent its shop fronts and the whole of the structure up above. Now this is terrific. I think this little alley, which goes around a dog leg, they missed a chance of a very good punning name. It should be called Richard Reynolds Row.
Yes, it should, yes. Yeah. And I think it's also important to notice that, you know, that we've got the cafe here, which is called Tabouche.
Yes.
And if you're going to come and sit and have a coffee in Tabouche, it all looks terribly modern in this alleyway. Look up, because otherwise you'll miss the heavenly glory above you.
I think that puts it right side.
Yeah.
Start at the bottom. This is the corner of Tabouche. Look at those beautiful tiles. You'll see the same sort of tiles set into the columns of the shop front. You'll see them on the Chinese restaurant opposite St. John's Chapel. And that again has to be one of Rowe's buildings, a very florid one. But look at those brackets up above. There are hanging iron pieces which are almost like censers or something like that. You can imagine incense smoke coming out of them. And there's a very strong cornice going round the corner. All the lines go gracefully and strongly round the corner. Then up above, the whole corner is cut away, which is a most lovely piece of brickwork. It's a sort of squinch device to get you out to the square corner that the building occupies above, so that the uppermost rooms, but only the uppermost rooms, have a square corner to them. And then you have these long loping arches, and for contrast, the yellow brick quite a hard industrial yellow brick, gives way within the arches to a very strong red brick, which you'll see has black mortar in it. And that's designed to keep the whole thing very crisp. You have two windows per arch, which is why they're so long and loping. And then up above you have pairs of windows balanced on a keystone in the middle of the arch, so that the keystone has a big wide sill on either side. And then as you go up to the top, you get a little window which hides away between strange kind of dangly pieces of brickwork, which you'll find all over his work in the town. I love the way this thing looks now, that it's all scrubbed and clean. And I think that the best of the architectural features can be seen exactly from this corner, from the door coming out of T-Max. I don't know who designed the building on the left. I mean, it's been very, very much the B-bar. It's been changed a lot, but it has the curiosity of having been built as the town and university gymnasium. Now it's got, made out of bits of the earlier building, a splendid tower with a dome and a stag on the top. I think that Mr. Rowe did the bit down to the left, and probably the bit on the right. You can probably see the whole of the structures here as having been originally provided, bar perhaps the B bar or gen, by Rowe, rebuilding at various stages of his career because he was a safe pair of hands.
John took me next to take a fresh look at the extraordinary buildings by Rowe at the corner of Hobson Street and King Street. If one looks from opposite Darry's and the Cookhouse, previously the Cambridge Arms Pub, there are masses of intriguing features that could fill a good few minutes if you know what to look for. Please notice above and behind the pub an enormous curved wall of brickwork three stories high, with extraordinary detailing fitting its irregular counterparts each side. A cornice line with bricks posited at 45 degree angles. Rowe's ingenuity with plain facades and novel dormer windows is also evident. We notice decorative lilies and shallow shields on timber buildings, brick chimneys and zigzag brickwork designs, all adding grace and coherence to the buildings. And there are also things like parapets and arched chimney stacks beautifully crafted.
This was a very sensible place to put a brewery, because it had a medieval well going down the odd 100 foot into a source of absolutely clean water.
Fantastic.
And that was fairly rare in Cambridge, but it was the breweries who always got there first, it seems. And on occasions, not this one, but up on Castle Hill, some of the brewery wells became the sources of public water supplies later on.
Yeah.
And so on Castle Hill, there was for a long time, on a brewery site, there was a little pumping house from the 1930s, which supplied water to the taps of Cambridge Town. But what we'll do is just sneak in and look at the brew house at the back, which had its roof burnt out a couple of years ago. But look at it, it still says, yeah, Cambridge Brewery, established 1866, and there's the fresh water tank at the top, and that chimney would have done many things in the building. And it would also have got the water by pump up to the into the iron water tank on the top of the brickwork there. But it's a lovely bit of rebuilding, considering that everything that is wood, the whole upper half, disappeared in that fire, roof and all.
The other pubs he's credited with include the Earl of Derby, the Red Bull, the Fleur de Lys, the Backstreet Bistro, the White Swan, the Elm Tree, the Great Eastern, the Cambridge Arms, the Royal Standard and the Radigund. His handwriting should become clearly readable to you by now. Rowe's also responsible for the villas on the corner of Glisson Road, with arched doorways and lions' heads, and the entire corner of Station Road, which used to be the old Great Eastern Hotel. John next took me to see his very best buildings in Harvey Road, which gave Rowe his architectural reputation. And we noticed a high spire with octagonal rooms in Gresham Road, without shingles and a kind of geometrical stateliness, as John put it. Next time you pass the triangular green in Tennyson Road and Glisson Road, you can also see the very best of Rowe's work surrounding you, which was designed to house the newly married families of Cambridge dons. You can easily spot his work featuring Dutch gables, parapets and wooden porches, and they include things like castellated tops to some of the bays and Gothic features. The entire tour left me wondering, how can such a talented, important and prolific architect not be properly respected or famous in Cambridge for all his life's astonishing work? His last drawing office still exists today in Clarendon Street, his last residence in 1890, and probably should become a blue-plaqued registered monument to a man clearly of truly huge local stature, yet overlooked by so many. Wising Arts Centre in Bourne Village has announced new residences awarded to four artists after a fiercely competitive round of applications from 617 artists for just 12 places. The centre now welcomes Salvatore Arancio, Flora Parrott, Nielsen Ploegfelder and Stuart Whipps. In addition, and reinforcing the literary influences on residences, escalator artist in residence Patrick Coyle will document the year's programme through creative writing. The four artists will relocate to Wising for 6 weeks from the 1st of April, throughout which a series of public talks and events with invited local participants will expand thinking around the cosmos, the initial focus of which will be exploring the past, origins and knowledge. A full programme of events is to be announced soon. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I'm Simon Burton, and I hope you enjoyed the hour.